Okay. Ah, Susie, for you.
I wasn't going to ask tonight.
You've given up on me already. Just for you, Susie.
No, everybody.
No, they all, David Pogel especially likes the screen, so. Right? It's nice and big, David?
Nice and big.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so good evening all on Zoom and in person. So this evening we're speaking about the topic of Ayin Hara, and it's an interesting topic because this is a halacha class and not a machshava, not a Jewish thought class. But nonetheless, there are many practical applications of this question, this sugya, this topic of Ayin Hara, because it's not only something that comes up a lot, but it's also something that, as we'll see, does have a lot of bearing in halacha lemaisa, in contemporary halachic matters, and we'll see how relevant it should be for us for our lives. And it's interesting because of the fact that this topic is certainly more mystically based, and so you'll definitely... People can hear me, right? Helen, you hear me? Yeah, okay. So it's definitely more mystically based, and so as we tend to find in mystical matters, there will be, of course, the naysayers, but then there will be the people who are the opposite of naysayers. Is the opposite of naysayers yaysayers? Yeah, all right, we'll find the naysayers and the yaysayers. And the yaysayers will basically end up telling us that the matters where Ayin Hara is relevant in lahalacha is something that we have to be very careful about. And so we'll see what those matters are. We begin with our source sheet, where we're not going to read the first source, but it's a scene from Fiddler on the Roof, in which, of course, we hear about the evil eye. And you guys say, two, 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 right? The evil eye, you have to be so careful. And so the reason why this source is so important, even though, again, we're not going to... Forgive me if my acting skills are not up to par, so I'm not going to read the transcript. But the reason why it's important to mention is because the concept of the evil eye is something that has very much so made it out there into the larger culture. It's not something that you know about only if you are a religious Jew. It's something that you know about if you are even a cultural Jew. And even if you're not a Jew, the concept of the evil eye certainly goes way beyond Judaism and the Jewish culture. It's come up a lot throughout various historical contexts. We're not going to do as much of a deep dive as I think I probably would have enjoyed, and maybe some of you would have enjoyed as well, maybe for another time, to go through the evil eye in Egyptian culture and in various Mesopotamian cultures and the like. But this is something that has come up throughout human history, and so many people are aware of this concept. The question for us this evening is, how is it relevant for us? Where does it, A, come from, and B, how does it impact us in the year 2024? So if you take a look in source number 2, we have one of the earliest occurrences of the evil eye in which we are familiar with. The Torah never explicitly uses the language of the Ayin Hara, the evil eye, as we have it colloquially used nowadays, but it uses it in different contexts that the commentaries point out is alluding to the Ayin Hara as we know. So take a look in source number 2. It's the scene in which Hagar is being kicked out from the house of Abraham and Sarah, and they are getting ready to have them leave. So says the Pasuk in source number 2, she said to Abraham, Sarah is speaking to Abraham, cast out that slave woman and her son, Yishmael, for the son of that slave shall not share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. The matter distressed Abraham greatly, for it concerned a son of his. And what does Rashi say on the Pasuk? He says that the child, too, he placed on her shoulder. Why? Because Sarah had cast an evil eye upon him. So a fever seized him and he could not walk. So Yishmael was incapable of walking. Yishmael had fallen very ill. And the reason why, says Rashi, quoting a Medrash, is because she used the evil eye. What does it mean that she used the evil eye? So no one really knows exactly, but Rashi says she used the evil eye on him, and that caused her Yishmael to fall very sick. Again, no definition, but a sort of an intuitive understanding that, of course, we all know what the evil eye is. We have another pasuk that comes later on in source number 4 in the book of Shemos, in which we're taking a census. When you take a census of the Israelite men, according to their army enrollment, each shall pay Hashem a ransom for himself on being enrolled, that no plague may come upon them through their being enrolled. Rashi again says, For numbers are subject to the influence of the evil eye. And therefore, if you count them by their poles, pestilence may befall them, as we find that it happened in the days of David. So, again, we don't want to count people by number. This is, of course, where the very famous custom comes from. When you go to a minion or whenever you're in a context of counting, you either say, right, not one, not two, or if you fancy, you have a pasuk, Hoshia es amecha, right? So various mnemonics that people use to count, but don't definitely you can't say one, two, three, because that would be counting, and that would cause the evil eye to fall upon people, right? So these are very, very old rooted concepts that we have in our tradition. Not only do we have this concept of an evil eye speaking of some sort of a terrible force, but we also have it in different contexts as well. If you take a look at source number 6, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us that if you have the evil eye, you're going to be counted among the wicked people. And if you have the good eye, which we don't hear about too often, you'll be among the tzaddikim, you'll be among the righteous people. Take a look inside. Whoever possesses these three things, he is of the disciples of Abraham our father. And whoever possesses these other things, he's of the disciples of Bilam, the wicked. A good eye, a humble spirit, and a moderate appetite. Here, so that already gets some people off. He is of the disciples of Avraham, our father. An evil eye, a haughty spirit, and a limitless appetite. He is of the disciples of Bilam, the wicked. Right? So clearly, someone who has an evil eye, which is, again, thus far, not really how many of us conceptualize an evil eye. It's not really a trait that we understand someone has, but rather it's like this force or this thing that we tap into that we say, oh, the evil eye is going to be cast upon you. But for someone to be a beholder of the evil eye, that's not really synonymous with how we typically understand it. But it seems to be some sort of a trait that Bilam had. And indeed, we know that when Bilam went to curse the Jewish people, there is a concept that he used the evil eye, the force of the evil eye, to curse the Jewish nation. And so again, a Jewish person, you want to be someone who is following in the ways of righteousness, you follow in the ways of our forefather Abraham, so you go ahead and have the good eye. But if you want to be a bad person, then you have the evil eye, which will be interesting as we journey into some of the sources that we're about to see now, because there are many things in halacha that we avoid doing because we don't want to allow the evil eye to be cast on other people, which means that likely one would draw the inference that there are many more people than we'd like to think that seem to possess the evil eye, which is, again, problematic. If that means that you're going to be among the students of Bilam, you'll be one of the wicked people. How many wicked people do we have exactly that have this evil eye? So take a look now in source number 7. So the Gemara relates that Rabbi Yochanan was accustomed to go and sit at the gates of the women's immersion sites. Okay, so, right, so the women would go on mikveh night, they'd go to be tovel in the mikveh, and Rabbi Yochanan would sit outside. Why would he sit outside? Rabbi Yochanan, who was known for his extraordinary good looks, explained this and said, I'll never forget this. When I was, I'll never forget this Gemara. I learned it for the first time in 11th grade. And when I was in 11th grade, it's always a fun one, and I'll never forget. So Rabbi Yochanan was known for several things in particular. Other than his tremendous Torah scholarship and the like, he is known for being incredibly good looking. He's also known for being incredibly overweight. And so I'll never forget, one of the kids in my lovely 11th grade class said, Rabbi, I don't understand. How could it be that he's so good looking? Isn't he really fat? And the Rebbe responded, well, why can't someone who's overweight be good looking? And there was silence in the room, and no one knew exactly what to say or do. And I just sort of tucked myself behind the corner a little bit. And it evidently could be. Someone who is overweight could be very good looking. And so again, Rabbi Yochanan was known for his extraordinary good looks and explained this. And he said, when the daughters of Israel emerge from their immersion, they will look at me and will have children as beautiful as I. Right? So Rabbi Yochanan would sit outside of the mikvah and make sure that the women would see him first, because he would be on their minds, in a sense. They'd go home and have relations with their husbands, and amazingly, they'd have the beautiful children, just like the rabbi they saw on the way out of the mikveh. The sages asked him, Master, do you not fear the evil eye? He said to them, I descend from the seed of Joseph, over whom the evil eye has no dominion, and as it is written, Joseph is a bountiful vine on a spring. Ayin can mean both spring and eye, and Rabbi Abayu said a homiletic interpretation, do not read it alei ayin, rather ole ayin, above the eye, meaning that, all this to say, that the descendants of Yosef, they transcend the influence of the evil eye. So Rabbi Yochanan was not concerned that people would allow the evil eye to be cast upon him, because he was from the descendants of the of Joseph. What does it mean? That why would he be concerned about the evil eye in this circumstance? What would he be afraid of?
That he would not be there to have the women look at him, but he would be there to look at the women.
Okay, good. That's one way of saying it. Maybe it's because he was going to be led to not the evil eye as we understand it, but maybe the evil inclination, right? That the Yetzer Hara was going to be impacting him. What might be another way that we could understand the evil eye in this context? What was he afraid of? Or what were they afraid of for him? Okay, good. Another possibility is that his beauty would be so incredible that maybe they wouldn't make it all the way home. They just stop there at the mikvah door and say, okay, where can we go? Right, that's option two. Option three. What? That'd be a great way to ensure that, yeah. And option three would be maybe his beauty would be such a publicly noticed thing that people would begin to say, oh my gosh, you see that Rabbi Yochanan, he's so beautiful looking, whatever. And you have enough people talking about it and rumoring about it, and the evil eye would jinx it in a sense. It would be cast upon him. So that's probably what the Gemara means. But again, all these other possibilities are interesting as well and potentially plausible. Let's read. Okay, so we'll stop there for the Gemara. But okay, so we see over here a very critical rabbinic source in which the evil eye plays a big role. But nonetheless, Rabbi Yochanan says, even though the other rabbis were concerned about the evil eye, Rabbi Yochanan was not so concerned about the evil eye. If you take a look further in source number 8, another Gemara that talks about this, the sages taught with regard to a sign of blessing that one who earns a living from selling rods or jugs will never see a sign of blessing from them. What is the reason for this? Since their volume is great, the evil eye dominates them. People believe that one is selling more than he is actually selling. Right? So what does this mean exactly? Someone want to put this in their own words? Why does what is the evil eye dominating over here? What? Right. Sorry?
Business practices.
Okay, good. So it's impacting the business practices, but in what way?
That his personality is helping him close the sale.
Okay, maybe. Likely what the Gemara is trying to say over here is that when everyone is talking about something or someone, when everyone knows, oh, this is the knife salesman, he goes from door to door and he's selling, or the encyclopedia salesman going, all right, that's a little more relevant for some people here, right? So you have the encyclopedia salesman going door to door, and so everyone knows this is the guy that sells encyclopedias, or this is the guy that sells whatever, such and such a thing. And because everyone knows about it, so first of all, everyone feels like, oh, everyone is definitely buying something from this guy. I'm not going to buy something from this guy, but everyone else is buying something from this guy. But also the concern of the Gemara seems to be that if everyone is talking about someone else's financial matters and financial businesses, then that will be some sort of a negative force upon that person. And that's really the big concern that the Gemara has. Similarly, the sages taught, merchants who sell their wares in an alleyway adjacent to a thoroughfare where they are seen by all, and those who raise small livestock, which tend to damage other people's fields, and those who chop down good fruit trees, even if they were permitted to do so, and those who direct their eyes to the fine portion with the intention of taking that portion for himself when dividing an item with others, will never see a sign of blessing from them. What is the reason for this? It is that due to these actions, people wonder about him and pay special attention to his conduct, and due to that attention, his actions will not be blessed. So there was this big concern in the times of the Gemara that someone is, again, in the forefront of many people's lives. Every single day, thousands of people pass this certain merchant or whatever it might be, and everyone's going to be talking about him. And if the business is small and it's not particularly large, so the Ayin Hara, this evil speech, this evil eye, will sort of attack this person on some level, therefore, thereby limiting his business. So if he has a small business and it's being attacked, then forget about it, you're done. Maybe, though, if you're a really large business, so maybe it's not as much of a concern because of the fact that the evil eye will impact you, but again, it will only make a small impact on the larger business. So this was, again, another concern that Chazal had. You take a look at source number 9, and again, an additional Gemara in Tainus. And apropos blessings, Rabbi Yitzchak said a blessing is found only in an object that is hidden from the eye, not in an item visible to all, as public miracles are exceedingly rare. As it is stated, the Lord will command his blessing upon you in your barns. Rabbi Yitzchak's exposition is based on the linguistic similarity between some, okay, just different words, samoy and asmecha. Likewise, the school of Rabbi Yishmael taught the blessing is found only in an object that is not exposed to the eye. As it is stated, the Lord will command his blessing upon you in your barns. So why is this true, that the blessings are only going to be more profound and more clear and in private and not for public people?
Jealousy of other people.
Okay, good. Good. So if you're very private, you're not flaunting all of your belongings or flaunting your wealth in front of other people. So you're not going to be concerned about the ayin hara because no one knows about it. So, but as alternatively, if you are flaunting everything, then you are going to get people to talk and people talking and people start, so did you see how the beautiful necklace that the lady was wearing? Or did you see the very fancy suit, the very fancy car that person's driving? And so all these things lead people to talk. And that again creates an ayin hara for the person and could lead to negative things. Good so far? Yeah? Okay. Fine. A few more, one more statement of the Gemara. Take a look at source number 10. The Torah states, and the Lord will take away from you all sickness. In interpreting this verse, Rav says, the verse is speaking about the evil eye. And the Gemara comments, Rav conforms to his line of reasoning. As Rav went to a graveyard and did what he did, meaning he used an incantation to find out how those buried there died. And he said, 99 of these people died by the evil eye, and only one died by entirely natural means. What does that mean? What?
It was his time.
How could he? Yeah, okay, fine. The one person, it was their time, but the other 99 people? Right, so whatever this means exactly, the evil eye, and again, one should be very careful over here because people could start to think, oh, there's like Hashem in there, and then there's the evil eye. No, obviously the evil eye functions under the auspices of God, whatever the evil eye is, but nonetheless, Rav was able to determine, and again, however he did it, unclear, but he was able to determine that people died, a significant amount, evidently 99% of people died because of the fact that there was some sort of evil aspersion cast on them. And so this is obviously really noteworthy. If this is actually killing people and harming people's businesses and livelihoods and doing really terrible things for people, so we should hope that we have some level of awareness of what exactly this evil eye actually is so that we can know how to A, stop it, or B, make sure that we're not falling under a victim to whatever it is. So what actually is the ayin hara? And any thoughts?
Well, apparently in the ancient Middle East, at that time, the star Aldebaran, which happens to be a variable star, a red variable star, very visible, was referred to as the eye.
Okay.
And people were afraid of that because it changed. It didn't stay the same brightness all the time.
Ah, okay, good, good. Yeah?
When you say someone casts an evil eye, they're casting a spell. I think you use that term. Well, there's a clear halacha not to practice sorcery.
Oh, okay, good. Right, so
that's immediately what I thought of. So if someone is practicing sorcery like that, it's certainly
okay, fantastic, right? So certainly one of the things that an ayin hara is alluding to or makes it sound similar to is magic, doing sorcery, doing some sort of evil spells, putting those on people, and there's a blatant isser d'oraisa, Torah prohibition to do that. And so therefore, so obviously it's a bad thing to do, and it sort of explains what exactly it is. It's not like there's like some sort of laser beams coming out of someone's eyes, right? The evil eye, but it's actually just a code for using a spell or some sort of magical...
But to attribute Sarah for doing that...
Oh, okay, good, good. Right, so... take a look at source number 11. There is a fascinating Wikipedia entry on something called emission theory. So emission theory, or extramission theory, or extromissionism, is the proposal that visual perception is accomplished by eye beams emitted by the eyes. This theory has been replaced by intromission theory, which is that visual perception comes from something representative of the object entering the eyes. Modern physics has confirmed that light is physically transmitted by photons from a light source, such as the sun, to visible objects, and finishing with a detector, such as a human eye or camera, right? So there was this understanding, or at least this thought, that something is going on from the eyes to the other objects around us in the world. What exactly is going on? Well, certainly from a more ancient perspective, it was not always clear, but there was something was happening with our eyes and light, and right? Someone bring me a proof that specifically by looking in the dark, that you can see something maybe, or you would think that something is coming out of someone's eyes.
Well, first of all, the eye is a receptor.
Okay.
And you're reversing things.
I certainly it was reversed, but think from in non-modern understanding of things, but think way back when.
We could look at a cat.
Yeah.
The dark, you see the eyes. What
say again?
What? Only if there's some light.
Okay, look, good. So if you're in the dark, and so another good example of this is, let's say you're driving and God forbid you see a deer or some sort of animal in front of you, and their eyes catch your headlights, it looks like their eyes are glowing, right? So to the untrained eye, no pun intended, it would seem that there's some sort of beam emanating from their lights. And so why don't you see it during the day? Oh, because during the day there's light around, so you can't really see it, but perhaps some sort of a proof that there was a beam emanating from the eye. So now take a look further.
It's the same thing with, you take photographs of people.
Good.
You get the red eye.
The red eye, fantastic. They didn't have cameras back then, but yeah. Okay, good. In the 5th century BC.
Which is only a reflection from something else.
All right, JJ, okay. We get it. You're smarter than all the ancient people, but right. Let's keep going. In the 5th century, Empedocles postulated that everything was composed of four elements: fire, air, earth, and water. He believed that Aphrodite made the human eye out of the four elements, and that she lit the fire in the eye, which shone out from the eye, making sight possible. If this were true, then one could see during the night just as well as during the day. So Empedocles postulated that there were two different types of emanations that interacted in some way. One that emanated from an object to the eye, and another that emanated from the eye to an object. And he compared these outward flowing emanations to the emission of light from a lantern. Around 400 BC, emission theory was held by Plato. 300 BC, Euclid wrote Optics and Catatropics, in which he studies the properties of sight, and so on and so forth. We see that throughout history, certainly in ancient times, when people were beginning to be interested in these types of scientific matters, so people wanted to put culture and science and colloquial use of certain terms and understandings to scientific fact and try to find the comparison and either see if they overlap or see if they're in contradiction with one another. And one of these matters is related to the evil eye. So is the evil eye a scientific concept? And amazingly, we see that throughout, or again, certainly in the ancient times, there was a belief that something was coming out of the eye. And as we'll see, there were commentaries as well, even in later years, that held that there was some sort of a ray of something coming out of the eye, and that was seemingly the definition of an evil eye. Right? People think Superman was the first person with laser vision, but the truth is that it goes way back, laser vision. It goes back to the times of certainly the Gemara and biblical times as well. And I'm always careful when it comes to talking about things like this, and we have to find the fine line between mocking and having a little fun and really being respectful, because even though there are some things that seem to not be in line with our scientific understandings of things nowadays, just recognize that these people were incredibly intelligent individuals, and they simply were sometimes upholding scientific matters of their time, but in many other matters, they were far smarter than us, right? So let's be sensitive and not just assume that these people are fools if they're saying something that doesn't sound to make sense with our understanding of things nowadays. So take a look at the Ralbag in source number 12. He says as follows. We find that the counting of men is a cause of plague, and that which is mentioned in the matter of David, when he commanded the general of the army, Joab, to count Israel. And we do not know exactly what is the cause of this. And it seems that this matter relates to the matter of the evil eye. And the cause of the damage, which is found in it, according to what I think, is that certain excess vapors, which nature expels from the body, leave through the eye. And these vapors can possibly kill some people because they are poisonous to them and due to the ease of their becoming affected by them. And this is, according to what I think, the cause of the plague that is a consequence of the census. And therefore, some of the counted men will die as opposed to others due to a difference of nature between the recipients who are affected by this. Right? So this is a very serious statement. Again, scientifically, does not sound super accurate. That's certainly not for nowadays. But according to the Ralbach, he's saying, what is the evil eye? Well, it means literally there was something emanating out of people's eyes that for some people they were more susceptible than others. And as a result, when people would come face to face for this census, for the count, well, they would go ahead and be killed by this vapor. It doesn't, yeah?
I think it's interesting because he seems to be trying to demythologize it.
Okay, good, go on.
Trying to cast the evil eye in scientific.
Okay, fantastic.
As if he was trying to somehow put down the superstition behind it.
Okay, great, fantastic. So this is not some crazy external force, says the Ralbach. No, this is a very scientific matter. Again, science that we don't necessarily understand or subscribe to, but it's science. There's something coming out of the eyes killing the people, and that's all it is. Yeah, Anne?
It sounds almost like germs.
Okay, fantastic, great. It sounds exactly like it's a virus, right? So if 6 feet away from the person, you're not so concerned. Yeah, Joyce?
But even if there is no actual scientific basis for things coming out of the eye, we're probably all familiar with expressions like her eyes shut me with daggers, or her eyes are smiling, or her eyes are laughing. Expressions. And if people are sensitive,
looks could kill.
Very good. Yes. And so if somebody who is sensitive, emotionally sensitive to those kinds of physical expressions,
right,
then surely you could find people who might get sick, might be happy, whatever it is.
Fantastic. Yeah, 100%. Okay, and let's see one more source, 13, the Rabbeinu Yonah. So he says, Rabbi Yeshua says, the evil eye, its explanation is one who is not happy with his lot and places his eye on his fellow who is wealthier than he, thinking, when will I be as wealthy as the great wealth of this man? And this causes evil to himself and to his fellow. It is like the wise men of science say about everything that is his neighbor's. Vapor comes up from that thought and burns the things that he puts his eye towards with an evil eye. He also burns himself inside. Since he desires things, the thought of which he does not have the ability in his hand to materialize his, he destroys his body as he shortens his spirit and removes it from the world. And this is the evil eye, about which Rabbi Yeshua spoke. And the proof of this explanation is that here he said evil eye in the masculine, which is the one that put his eye for evil. And above it said evil eye in the feminine, the explanation of which is about the trait of stinginess. And it is not like the words of some of the commentators and the evil inclination and hatred of the creations, like their simple meaning, remove a person from the world. Right? Okay, so according to Rabbeinu Yonah, what is this evil eye? Also something physical emanating from the eye that's causing some sort of damage to the greater world around us. Now, the major question that we have to understand before moving any further and then getting into some practical applications is trying to understand why it is that God would let the world function like this, right? So even if there isn't something actually emanating from people's eyes, even if there isn't some sort of a force that we can tangibly understand, it's hard to believe that something functioned this way for thousands of years in culture after culture. They recognize this concept. And so even if it was somewhat relatively remotely on some strange planet to be true, well, why would God allow some weird evil force to impact other people? And more than that, even if you say the whole thing is a Baba Maisa, maybe we will see some do say, well, why would any of these great rabbis over the years who held of this, who believed that it was a thing, why would they think that Hashem would allow the world to function this way? Why should Sarah Iminu, why should she have any powers to go ahead and hurt someone else, even if it was her hated stepson, right? Why should she have the ability to cause such pain on other people through some mystical force? So if you take a look at source number 14, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Rabbi Chaim Ibn Avitar, the great Moroccan rabbi of the 1700s, he explains as follows. In order to understand the matter properly, we must first discuss the condition of the person or people who have been subjected to a curse. If the accursed had been guilty, he will obviously suffer harm for his guilt, even if he had not been cursed at all. If, on the other hand, the person who was subjected to a curse was innocent and had not done anything which would make him subject to punishment at the hands of God, the curse would boomerang on the one who uttered it. Right? So first of all, so this is over here, the Orach Haim HaKadosh is speaking in the context of the curse that Bilaam brought on the Jewish nation. Right? And everyone wants to know, why should the curse that Bilaam brings against the Jewish people, why should anyone care about that? God in particular, but anyone. Who should be so nervous about a terribly wicked guy cursing the Jewish people? So explains the Orach Haim HaKadosh, well, first, simply, you have to recognize and understand that the way the world works is that if someone is cursed, again, whatever that means exactly, but if someone is cursed, then there is more likelihood that something bad could happen to them. Someone who isn't cursed, well, okay, you could wish all the terrible things upon them. Nothing bad is going to happen to them that will be against God's will. Let's keep going further. The difference between blessings and curses is that if someone receives a blessing, though he did not do anything to deserve it, seeing that the power of good exceeds that of the power of evil, the recipient of the blessing will enjoy it, though he may not have done anything to deserve it. However, God would certainly not cause harm to a person who did not deserve to come to harm. The principal effect of a curse, then, has to do with God's attribute of extending his patience to the sinners and delaying their punishment. God's patience extends both to the righteous and to the wicked who are bent on sinning. It is one of the 13 attributes God revealed to Moshe and operates at all times when God is not angry. God's anger, however, is short-lived, as we know from Psalms 36, for he is angry but for a moment. At such a time, the attribute of justice is the ascendancy, and the attribute of Erech HaPayim is temporarily suspended. Similarly, when a person curses his fellow man, the effect of the curse is that God will no longer extend his attribute of Erech HaPayim to the guilty person who has now also been cursed. As a result, okay, and this is the punchline, the attribute of patience may be suspended as far as that person is concerned. If the person cursed did not have to depend on the attribute of Erech HaPayim, of God's patience in the first place, then the curse is quite ineffective against him. Right, so you see what's going on over here? It says the Orach Haim HaKadosh, you have to understand very simply. You have someone who is liable for some sort of a punishment, but God is incredibly merciful. And so God, very often, even if one is deserving of punishment, God does not bring that punishment upon an individual, right? And there are various calculations that we don't understand that God uses to determine when to refrain from punishment. But, says the Orach Haim HaKadosh, let's say you have additional factors that lead to this guy being punished or suffering terribly. For example, let's say you have someone going out and cursing that guy. So it's not just God, quote unquote, that wanted to punish him, but now he has mercy. Well, there's another guy, there's another force in the world, just a human being, but another person nonetheless who is wishing bad. And whatever that does something in the upper world. And more than that, let's say you have something like an evil eye, that several people and hundreds of people see this person and they cast their evil eye on them because they see that person's very wealthy or whatever it might be, right? So all of these extra additional negative things, whatever they are, even though it's hard to tangibly put our minds to understand what they might be, nonetheless, we can understand on some level that, okay, if there is this major force of good, of God being merciful, preventing punishment from coming to a person, but then all this negative comes in, well, then perhaps that negative force has the ability to uproot the positive, merciful force of God. Again, when we talk about these terms, it's sort of hard to tangibly understand what they are, but conceptually, I think we can wrap our hands around, wrap our heads around it on some level. If you have someone, however, who has done nothing wrong and is deserving of no punishment, then you could wish all the terrible things upon that person. Too bad, nothing is going to happen because there's no mercy to be messed with, because it's not mercy that's judging this person, it's judgment, and it seems like the person is flawless. Let's read a little bit further. Okay, well, so, okay, you answer the question. What do you think?
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Could be. Well, let's talk about the Torah, though. So Bilaam cursed the Jewish people. Bilaam was a horribly wicked man. Why are we concerned of his curse? So it would seem that even though someone is terribly wicked, we're not. We still see it as something that we should be weary of. Again, is the curse of a rabbi worse than the curse of Bilaam? Probably. But is the curse of Bilaam significant? Absolutely. Right? That's why people are so nice to the rabbi, because they don't want to have any. We still seem to care about even a wicked person who curses. So let's read this last paragraph over here of the Or HaChaim. Let me explain something else. Every person who commits a sin thereby causes some blemish in the particular midah, virtue, in the celestial regions, which fulfillment of the commandment he did not fulfill was intended to strengthen. So someone is commanded to wear tefillin. Men are commanded to wear tefillin every single day. When a man does not wear tefillin every single day, well, there was something that was not fix, right? This is obviously Kabbalistic and Hasidic type of a concept, but there's some midah, some attribute that someone was working on that needed to be fixed by the tefillin, but the tefillin doesn't do that. It does not strengthen it. He does not thereby destroy the entire midah, attribute, or virtue, but he causes damage to the root of his soul. The damage expresses itself in that certain spiritually negative forces, which ought not to possess any hold on his soul, have been enabled to lay some claim to his soul. So that is how the Or HaChaim HaKadosh would conceptualize the evil eye. It's not this force that is beyond God. No, it's the opposite. It's that God runs the world, but there are times when God allows his mercy to be overrun if there is enough negative forces out there counteracting the positive, merciful forces that God is beholding. There are additional explanations that are given that are actually quite beautiful and to speak to the unity, not just of all Jews, but to the unity of mankind. Take a look at source number 15, the Michtav Me'eliyahu Rav Dessler says as follows. I apologize, just in Hebrew, but we'll translate. Pu'ulas ayin hara mushreshes be'ovda she'nefashos kol b'nei ha'adam kishurot me'ururot zo bazo. He says that the concept of an ayin hara is very much so rooted in the fact that every human soul is intertwined with one another. And when it comes to our spiritual source, our life spirit, they're all dependent on one another. So again, whatever this means, not entirely clear. But what he's saying is that so someone has a soul A and soul B are intertwined, and again, they're connected somehow in the upper worlds, and all of a sudden, soul A has some negative thoughts which impact the upper worlds from his perspective, and soul B over here is also connected to those upper worlds. So his negative thoughts go up here, and then they trickle down to soul B. Again, we don't understand what this means exactly, but that's how Rav Dessler is explaining it. Since we're all intertwined with one another, one negative force of one person can impact another individual who seemingly they may have nothing else to do with one another other than the fact that they are both human beings in the great world that we live in. And Rav Kook also seems to say a similar idea. Take a look, source number 16. Because of the fact that our souls are intertwined with one another, that is specifically what gives the ayin hara, the evil eye, power to impact us. Amnam, lo tefal, ki im al yedei chalishos hanefesh hamispa'eles. V'tochein hachalishos ba al yedei ma shelo timtza es akareis right, so he says, nonetheless, don't fret because there are much greater concerns out here that one should be worried of, not just the evil eye, and there's such a more complex perspective of how this is impacting us. But nonetheless, we understand v'nefesh chalusha kazos shehashpa hachitzona po'eles aleha lios merkazit et derechei abachayim tekabel al nakala roshem me'ashpa hachitzona l'ra gamkin. So it makes sense on some level, though, that we should have some concern that there should be some sort of external factor that could impact our souls. Okay, All of this to say that clearly there is a lot of arguments that are made that it does have impacts even to this day. Again, what it is, how it works, not entirely clear, but that it is there. This is so true that it's relevant for us nowadays that it does impact our halacha in several different ways. So one well-known example is when it comes to the concept of getting an aliyah, right? So we know that two brothers are not typically called up one after the other when reading from the Torah. Where does that come from? Ayin hara, right? The reason why we don't do that, again, to this day, is because we're concerned of ayin hara. What's the ayin hara that we're worried about? Yeah, what's the evil eye that we are worried about in this context? Okay, why? Flesh it out. What's the concern?
If they're both up there, that calls attention. And that is what's calling attention from all the other sources. Is what brings
okay. All right, so fantastic. So what's happening over here? You have Brother A getting called up, and Brother A is Ben whoever, and Ben Avraham. And then all of a sudden you have Brother B who gets called up, and he's also Ben Avraham. Whoa, whoa, whoa. These are two brothers. Ooh, the family of Avraham. I'm going to get the family of Avraham. So all of a sudden, again, no evil intentions per se, but everyone is sort of focused on them because they're the central focal point of what's going on in Shul at the moment. So everyone's having their eyes focused on them, and that could lead to bad things. Take a look inside. The Shulchan Aruch. Yeah. Well, so usually what happens is that they try to separate it with someone, right? So you could have, let's say you have a bar mitzvah boy, right? So you have the bar mitzvah boy gets the first aliyah, so we also don't like father and son. So you get the bar mitzvah boy, and then maybe you would have like a cousin, and then you would have the father, and so on and so forth. We try to separate it. It doesn't mean that you can't have multiple family members, but we try to eliminate anyone who has some sort of direct, immediate connection with one another, in particular brothers, but others as well. So take a look. Two brothers may be called up for an aliyah, one after the other, and so to a son after the father. But we refrain from doing so only because of ayin hara, meaning halachically it's okay, but we traditionally don't do it because of ayin hara. And even if one was called up for the seventh aliyah and the other one was called up for maftir, the second one should not be called up by his name because of ayin hara. Right? So we're terribly concerned about this. And if you take a look at the Mishnah Berurah, right, doesn't make a difference if they're brothers from the mother or brothers from the father. And let's say someone says, I'm not so concerned. Call me up anyways. I don't worry about the ayin hara. Right, so we don't even like to do this nonetheless for sons and even grandsons. He says if you need to be lenient in some cases, you can be, but we try not to be because we're very concerned about this. However, you take a look at the Aruch HaShulchan in source number 19, and he says as follows. Technically, as we saw a second ago, you are allowed to call up two brothers, one after the other, v'haben achar ha'av el hefech, or a son after the father, or vice versa. Ella shenahagu limnoa mizeh mishum ayin hara. We have a custom to not do this. V'afilu ha'echad hu ha'shvi'i v'asheni mafir, gam kin choshin lazeh. No matter what, even if you have the seventh ali and the maftir, okay, we don't want to try to do that. V'davka b'shabes, shahamaftir korei bazo ha'sefer Torah, shekulam karu, aval b'yom tov v'chein b'shabes rosh chodesh v'chanuk av arba parshios, shahamaftir b'sefer Torah acheres lo chashu l'ayin hara. So you hear what he's saying over here? For some reason, if you have two Torahs that you take out that Shabbos, or if you have two Torahs that are taken out in that instance, and all of a sudden you have, so Brother A gets the last Aliyah from that first Torah, and then they have, Hagba and Glila in between, whatever. Okay, so no one's focused on that guy, and now all of a sudden you have his brother called up a minute or two later with the second Torah. That's okay. We're not concerned about that. Because again, it has also to do with people focusing on who is there in the forefront, and the Brother A already, he's long gone. Because he got pushed aside when the guy tried to lift up the Torah, and so we're not as concerned anymore. Okay, other situations we're not so concerned about. But here is the kicker line of the Aruch HaShulchan: Uman delo kapid. If we don't care about this, if we're not so concerned about this, Yachol asos kemoshe yirtzo. We could do whatever we want. right? So that's a great rabbi, right? So that's how you know that Rosh Hashanah was a shul rabbi, because you can do whatever you want at the end of the day, right? So that was a joke. So he says, if people are not so concerned or fearful of this, we're not going to be so strict in the matter. So if you have two brothers who come to shul and they say, we are not strict, we think this is all a joke, go ahead and call them side by side. No one will care. It's interesting to note that it takes a certain level of let's call it rational haughtiness to get up there, because even the biggest rational thinkers among us, all of a sudden, if someone says that it's not really allowed, a lot of rabbis don't do it, many people are it's not worth the risk, right? Even if it's a 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000,000, it's not worth the risk. So it takes a lot for someone to say, I really don't care, but okay, that is an option if someone really doesn't care. So much so are we concerned about these things, l'halacha, that even when it comes to walking out with a charm or a pendant on Shabbos, so back in the day, they used to have charms or pendants that they made to sort of counteract some of the evil spirits. Ayin Hara would be one of them, but they were real things that were written that people would have in like a necklace or something like that. So could you carry that on Shabbos when there is no Erev, right? So what do you think?
Well,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, good. Right? So Susie says if you hold by it, maybe it should be okay. Anne seems to be very bothered by this, that you shouldn't allow it. So, okay, I think we know who thinks what here.
It's okay, unless it's part of your clothing.
Okay, but so again, it's a necklace, but the necklace is holding a charm or something in it. Okay, so the Shulchan Aruch paskins that it's totally permissible to go ahead and walk outside when there is no Eruv with this in your, again, you have a little necklace with the thing inside, totally okay, because of the great necessity of this. This is, it's not, you're not carrying on Shabbos, no. This is part of your garment because you can't even move without this to ward off these evil spirits. Okay, so what about like nowadays in the 2024? Like, so what are we thinking over here? So there's a few areas that are important for us to hone in on. First of all, is this question of truly how careful do we have to be as a general rule? And then there is the other major category, which we'll only tangentially touch on for tonight, and that is the question of the red strings. People know the red strings. Oh, the holiest thing in the world, the red strings. You go to the old city of Jerusalem or anywhere in Israel, really, and you could purchase a red string for $1. It will protect you everything bad in life, this $1. So how could you not buy that red string, right? So it's a very important red string. And the red string is, of course, to ward off evil spirits, in particular, to ward off the evil eye. So, okay, let's see one piece before we get to that. So you take a look at source number 21, sort of Moshe Feinstein, of course, the major halachic decisor of the 20th century, in America. He says as follows, Be'inyan ayin hara, vada yesh lachosh. He says, if you're asking me what I think, should you be careful about ayin haras and things like that? Absolutely you should be careful about it. Like, you'd be silly not to care about it. It's been so highly spoken about for so many thousands of years. What, you're going to wake up one day and say, this is not rational enough for you? So of course be careful about it. Aval, but don't go crazy, right? Like, you don't have to be so careful. Like, careful to a point. Haklal mandalo kapid lo kaptina behedya. We have a general rule that if someone is not concerned about things, then they don't have to be careful about it, right? And so this very much so applies to this area. It's a fascinating reality of halacha that if someone is concerned about it, then we say we're concerned. If someone is not concerned about it, then we're not concerned. So sort of like a circular logic, but the point is that if you are someone who the ayin hara scares you even a little bit, so don't do it, because bad things might happen. But if you're someone who thinks this is total baba mises, you're good to go. You don't have to worry about anything bothering you. Gehad matzino bezugos pesachim, right? So in Maseches Pesachim, we have this concept of zugos. We don't like things in pairs. Anything that comes in pairs, we think that has to do with demons. But it's ridiculous, demons. So most of us think that's silly, right? So if you're not worried about it, so go ahead, you don't have to worry about it. If you're remotely worried about it, you should be worried about it. Aval eini roeh bezeh she'ishat se'ira shu kederach ha'olam lehisaber she'yesh shayach ayin hara ve'in lahakpid bezeh. Right? So he said, what about a woman who has twins, right? So you don't like pears, Leve, right? And so he said, don't worry about that. That's a little cuckoo. You don't have to worry about that exactly. Ubedavar harambam v'hameiri v'adai lo yaflegu ala gemar bedvarim shechushin la'ayin hara aval ein lahakbir kol kach. So the Rambam in particular, everyone knows the Rambam Maimonides is the great rationalist. So he thinks a lot of this stuff is just totally out to lunch, right? But still, he's not going to tell you to disagree with the Gemara. He's just going to say, okay, listen, it doesn't have to be the number one concern in your life. But to say that you should just totally disregard it, that's a hard thing to do. V'gam rak b'davar shalom matzoy lefi derech ha'olam shayach lechush v'lo v'ledvarim mitzuyim. Right? So you should be somewhat careful about it. But again, it doesn't have to control your life. And so what about this thing of the red string? So again, another expert Wikipedia entry over here, source number 22, wearing a thin scarlet or crimson string as a type of talisman, which is, by the way, the word talisman should already be just a red flag, is a Jewish folk custom, which is practiced as a way to ward off misfortune, which is brought about by the evil eye. The tradition is popularly thought to be associated with Kabbalah, I think, and religious forms of Judaism, right? So what do we think about this? So there's a tshuva that's written over here. Take a look at source number 23, the final source that we'll deal with today. Is there a source for tying a red string on a child's carriage and so on because of the evil eye? The answer? That was the universal practice, and they were careful to tie a red string on a carriage and crib of a child because of the evil eye. All of these are the practices of elderly women regarding which the Rashba wrote that we should not mock their words and practices, for they are certainly founded in the sacred mountains, even if we don't know the reasons. Right, so this perspective, I think, is a really important point to conclude on. Listen, are there plenty of people out there who will tell you that the red strings and things like this are absolute craziness? Absolutely. If someone is trying to sell you a red string for $100 that will save your life, should you do it? Absolutely not, right? But to say that this is all total craziness that we should just totally throw out, I think we do risk throwing out the baby with the bathwater a little bit. And so one should be sensitive to that. If there is some reality here, okay, listen, that you have a lot of tradition to say it's relied on. Are you obligated to wear the red string? Certainly not. Right, but when it comes to being fearful of the Ayin Hara in general, again, we believe that God controls the world, so we don't like to really be fearful of outside forces, but we do believe that there is some element in our tradition that talks about the fact that there is this Ayin Hara, that there is this evil eye, evil force out there, and truth be told, we try to be as sensitive as we can to the traditions, even if we don't always understand it. And so while we may not fully subscribe to it, as many of the modern-day poskim talk about, we should certainly not mock it, and we should have some level be sensitive to it. So when it comes to things small that don't really impact us so greatly, like having two brothers getting an aliyah one after the other or the like, these kinds of things we should try to be sensitive to. Again, if it impacts us on a greater level, I can't even think of something right now, but some example you can think of that might impact you on a much greater level, then one should be not as bothered by that if it, you know, one should not feel that their hands are tied and they can't move forward. There is, and we'll close with this concept that people sometimes will say is that, I'm doing this or hopefully that's going to happen, Bli Ayin Hara. They'll say the words, Bli Ayin Hara. It should be without an Ayin Hara. I'm not entirely sure what that's about exactly, just because of the fact that it seems to be odd. Like, all of a sudden I could do whatever I want as long as I say it should be without an Ayin Hara. So it's and that's also, I think, what the Fiddler on the Roof scene. It should be without the evil eye and you spit three times, right? So it's hard to believe that is of much value. However, in the same way that we value the tradition of the evil eye on some level in our tradition to this day, so too I would argue that this notion of saying Bli Ayin Hara does have some value as well. Again, to what extent is the value? You can't measure these things. But okay, if someone wants to say Bli Ayin Hara in a case where they're concerned of an Ayin Hara, I'm not sure it's the end of the world. One should be careful that they don't like go a little crazy, because if you think about these things too hard, you might end up saying, yeah, you can go a little cuckoo. So don't do that. But on a moderate level, someone wants to be sensitive and careful about these things, and to use a term like that, it seems like that would be totally okay, and even preferable, perhaps. So with that, we'll conclude, and if anyone has any questions, happy to take them. But if not, wish everyone a beautiful evening. Yeah.